picture on the death of the president. A few hours after Pravda had made up its mind that this tragic story should be told, other satellite countries began following suit. From this divided city, Berlin, the East German communist leader, Walter Ulbricht, one of the most intense enemies of the United States, sent a message to President Johnson expressing grief and indignation. Then, Ulbricht spoke of the impious forces of terrorism which had caused the president's death. This East German remark paralleled an important fragment of what Moscow had said. The Russians in Pravda wrote that commentators in Dallas linked this crime with the activities of rightist organizations. Well, the London Daily Worker spoke of racialist barbarians in the United States. Now, it is possible to argue that these references to rightist organizations are what have got the world communist press in a bit of a propaganda corner. Because when that story was set in type in Pravda and in the London Daily Worker, it was known only that a white man had been involved as the assassin. Later, when the world learned that the chief suspect had once lived in Russia, where he tried to obtain Soviet citizenship, it was apparently too late to change the implication of the Moscow line and the echoes that spread out through Eastern Europe. And therefore, I think it will be interesting to see what the Soviet propagandists will make of this story tomorrow.
Yes, it's they have got themselves into a corner there. As I guess we both recall, their reactions are not necessarily fast at any time. There has been, as far as you know, I presume, no attempt to recoup or to change the position from the radio services or in the press of that part of the world, has there, I guess?
No, I don't believe so, Joe, although the circuit, I'm sorry, is such at this hour of the morning here that I'm not reading you as well as I'd like to.
All right. Well, we'll try to get back to you later when you have more for us and when the circuit is better. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
John Chancellor of NBC News in Berlin on the saddened reaction of that city to which Mr. Kennedy went and in which he pronounced that he was a Berliner, meaning, of course, that he had joined these people fighting for their freedom. And the saddened reaction of Mayor Willy Brandt, a great friend to America, and to Mr. Kennedy. There are items coming in from all over the world, and there are other things that we want to talk to, too, and people that we want to talk to. I think we can bring you up to date on the latest, on the actual details before we go on with these things. NBC's Tom Pettit is in Dallas. We on the latest in connection with the police activities there. We go now to Tom Pettit in Dallas.
Dallas Police Chief J.E. Curry says, "I believe we have the right man." He is discussing 24-year-old Lee Oswald, prime suspect in the assassination of President Kennedy. Questioning of Oswald has been suspended briefly while paraffin tests are run to determine if he is linked with the rifle believed to be the murder weapon. Oswald earlier was charged with the murder of police officer J.D. Tippit, who had gone to apprehend Oswald. But he denies killing President Kennedy, says he is being held because he was in Russia. Tom Pettit, NBC News at Dallas Police Headquarters.
Now, looking at items in connection with both the sad affair and with the future. From China, by the way, the other part of the communist world, there was absolutely no reaction of any kind so far this morning. There are no American correspondents, of course, allowed in Red China. The Reuters news agency is there. Their correspondent reports that there was absolutely no attention given. The news came too late for morning papers, but early morning news broadcasts also ignored the story. In answer to questions, the foreign ministry said its reaction to the news would be made known when it was available. And when that sort of statement is made in Red China, the Reuters correspondent there is extremely careful not to challenge it too much if he wants to stay. Diplomats spent the morning glued to radio sets listening to shortwave foreign news broadcasts. Mr. Kennedy's death is unlikely to cause much sorrow, says Reuters, among the communist Chinese, or to cause a halt to continuous attacks on United States policy. Earlier this week, a major Communist Party statement referred to the late president as, quote, the wildest militarist of all times, the wildest plotters of a new world war, and the most ferocious enemy of world peace, which is about as much of an accolade, perhaps, as the president could have hoped to have received. The new president, Mr. Johnson, what about him? We spoke of the vast numbers of problems that he faced, just the ones that came up in one news conference, these questions of world scope involving our country and its tremendous place, its tremendous problems in the world, and our problems at home, with which Mr. Kennedy had been suffering and striving so greatly. Here is something on Mr. Kennedy's own background, and it shows him as a man eminently equipped to assail this post. Lyndon Johnson is the 8th American vice president to succeed to the White House on the death of a president, the 4th to gain this position by an assassination. He is 55 years old. He is a Texan. He was chosen by the slain President Kennedy for second place on the 1960 Democratic ticket to strengthen it in the South. And he is credited with holding some of the southern states for Kennedy in the paper-thin Democratic victory 3 years ago. Before he became vice president, Mr. Johnson was Democratic leader of the Senate and was regarded as one of the most skillful strategists ever to function in Congress. As vice president, he did little to intrude on the jealously guarded prerogatives of Congress. I think this is one of the important things to remember. We cannot help but discuss what is going to happen on the morrow, because this is the situation. Our country must continue to go on. President Kennedy has died, but the United States is here and its problems remain. And Mr. Kennedy, as a skilled leader in the Senate, as the man who was tremendously respected there and who was followed by various coalitions, despite the fact that the Democratic-Republican split was great, is a man who can be expected to have a substantial influence there. Only to a certain degree, however, since the Senate continues to jealously guard its prerogatives, as Mr. Johnson himself displayed. On several occasions, as a matter of fact, during his vice presidency, the question was asked, sometimes of him directly and sometimes in public meetings, why Mr. Johnson, with all of his intimate knowledge of each of the senators of the United States, didn't do something to push this or that piece of legislation, which the administration wanted badly to seem to be made into law. And the answer always was that Mr. Johnson knew, because of this very experience to which people referred, that trying to push the Senate, which is so carefully guarding its prerogatives, is a very dangerous thing to do and will probably cause an evil reaction rather than a good one. It remains to be seen whether he will be more successful than Mr. Kennedy was in getting action from this Congress, which has been a Congress most difficult to deal with in many areas so far as the president's most important programs are concerned. He presumably will replace some, perhaps many, of the cabinet members and other White House advisors with men of his own choice. This is not necessarily a condemnation insofar as Mr. Johnson is concerned of the men who are in the cabinet, but you must remember that our system of government differs greatly from that of parliamentary countries such as Great Britain. In our country, the cabinet members are responsible directly to the president. Under the Constitution, they really have very little legal existence. The president must assume responsibility for all of the actions of members of his cabinet, and so they must be not merely men that he can respect, but men with whom he is certain he can work. Now, this can devolve to a matter of personalities. It would seem that Mr. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, would be one of those who will stay if he cares to, because Mr. Johnson has many times expressed his tremendous respect for Mr. McNamara and has spoken of him as the strongest man in the cabinet. The course that we mentioned of changing members of the cabinet was followed by former President Harry Truman after he succeeded Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the White House on April 12, 1945. Mr. Kennedy was the first president to fall to an assassin's bullet since the creation of the Secret Service to protect presidents after the assassination of William McKinley in 1901. It reminds me of this, too. I spent a good part of this day out on the streets of this city, and you can't get away from the fact that a lot of people were saying, where was the Secret Service? I have followed presidents of the United States on tours through several countries and through this one. I followed Mr. Khrushchev on his tour here and in France and in Indonesia and in India. And after this, and having talked to many people from the Secret Services of countries all over the world, some of them countries in which there is much less freedom than here, we always came to the same conclusion, that if there is a man with sufficient intelligence and determination and skill, no Secret Service of any kind in any country can prevent his death. And that, of course, is what has shocked America today. The death of a president sends shockwaves through government and the nation, even though his successor is a member of the same political party. And it was a shock to Mr. Truman, you'll remember, who took his apprenticeship in Congress, as did Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Johnson. I felt like the moon, the stars, and all the planets had fallen on me, Mr. Truman said a day after he was sworn in. I've got the most terrible, responsible job a man ever had. Speaking of Mr. Truman, he issued a statement today. We have that statement at this moment, and I'll give it to you in just a moment. It is time that we break, and we shall be returning to you in just a few seconds.
The NBC Radio Network will stay on the air with continuous coverage until 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will resume broadcasting at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time Saturday, tomorrow, with continuous coverage. We pause 10 seconds for station identification.
This is WNBC AM and FM New York. The time is 20 seconds past 11 o'clock, and the New York City temperature 57 degrees.
We spoke of former President Truman and his reaction at the time of the death of the former President, Mr. Roosevelt. He issued this statement today from Independence, Missouri. I am shocked beyond words at the tragedy that has happened to our country and to President Kennedy's family today. The president's death is a great personal loss to the country and to me. He was an able president, one the people loved and trusted. Mrs. Truman and I send our deepest sympathy to Mrs. Kennedy and the family. Mrs. Truman said her husband will attend the funeral. She said she has not decided whether she will accompany the former president. Getting back to the background and the career of Lyndon Johnson, the new president of the United States, the people in Washington who observed them most closely noted that Mr. Johnson and Mr. Kennedy were not intimate friends, but even though this was so, the late president gave Mr. Johnson many assignments, goodwill missions abroad, and the chairmanships of the Equal Opportunities Commission and the Space Advisory Council at home. He regularly attended cabinet and National Security Council meetings and Kennedy's weekly conferences with congressional leaders. It has not always been so, and this is extremely important in this administration. Mr. Johnson's background in the Senate, his tremendous involvement in all of the affairs of the Senate as its leader during all of the years he so successfully led it from the Democratic Party point of view, all of this gives him a tremendous amount of knowledge of these things where knowledge is most urgently required. And his trips abroad. He went to Europe and he went to Latin America. Mr. Johnson was very well acquainted with leaders of these people. And I think one of the most important things to remember in connection with this is that, like Mr. Kennedy, he was a professional politician in what should be considered the best sense. A professional politician in the sense that he lived, breathed, and ate politics all of the time, which means not just the affairs of a party or of two parties or of a district, but the affairs of the nation and its problems and its needs. He kept regularly abreast of these things, and this has not always been the case with vice presidents of the United States. Mr. Nixon was well acquainted with affairs of government, and President Eisenhower made sure that this was the case. However, before that time, Mr. Truman himself had far less acquaintance with the problems of the government and the workings and functionings of the government than did either Vice President Nixon or now, in this case, Mr. Johnson, the new president of the United States. The trips abroad were consequential. The chairmanship of the Equal Opportunities Commission means that Mr. Johnson can speak with authority of the problems of civil rights in which he concerned himself. The Space Advisory Council, of which he was chairman, is extremely important because our space program is, again, one of the problems that he must face. Congress has already lowered the boom on part of the funds for the presidential space program, and there is now a strong question as to whether this program will be put into effect in time, as was promised, to get a rocket, manned rocket, to the moon and back in this decade. This, again, is a problem of vast scope, one that Mr. Johnson does know. Turning to other problems, we have the other question of Mr. Johnson's health. which should be considered. If you will remember, Mr. Johnson did suffer a heart attack 8 years ago. But today, heart specialists predicted that he would be a vigorously healthy chief executive despite this. They based their estimate upon the vigorous life Mr. Johnson has led since his months-long recuperation in 1955. He has, as the saying goes, been through the political wars, including the 1960 election campaign as President Kennedy's running mate, and has even faced a mob, one specialist recalled. In the unanimous opinion of three specialists, a man such as Mr. Johnson, who has had a complete recovery of years-long duration, can face up to the most exacting task, including that of being president. They pointed to the example of President Dwight David Eisenhower, who suffered a heart attack during his first term, but went on to win re-election and still, as we all know, is vigorously and happily healthy. The question of the last rites is one which involves all of America, too. And here are the figures and here are the facts in that area. The last rites for President John F. Kennedy will be performed in Washington Monday at a pontifical requiem mass, which will be celebrated by Richard Cardinal Cushing, Archbishop of Boston. This was announced by the White House tonight in a statement which also said that former Presidents Eisenhower and Truman would arrive in Washington this weekend to join mourning dignitaries. The slain president's body will lie in repose in the East Room of the White House from 10 in the morning until 6 in the evening tomorrow, it was announced. Only the immediate Kennedy family will be present for the first hour, that is, between 10 and 11. No one from the public or from the dignitaries present will be allowed in at that time. President Johnson will head a high-ranking group which will view the body in repose between 11 and 2. Former President Eisenhower will be present at that time, according to the White House announcement, as will Speaker of the House John McCormick and Chief Justice Earl Warren. The body of President Kennedy will lie in state in the rotunda of the Capitol on Sunday and Monday, according to the White House. Mr. Truman plans to arrive in Washington on Sunday. Former President Herbert Hoover has expressed his regret that he will be unable to attend, it was announced by the White House. The former Republican president had a serious operation last year and has been ailing. He is a man of great age. Kennedy's body, the president's body, will be moved to an official cortege from the White House to the rotunda of the Capitol at 1 p.m. Sunday. It will lie in state there until Monday at 11 a.m. And at that time, of course, all of his fellow Americans who wish to see him will be able to do so. His body will be moved at that time to St. Matthew's Cathedral in downtown Washington for a pontifical requiem mass at noon. This will be celebrated by Cardinal Cushing. The public will be permitted to file past the bier in the rotunda shortly after its arrival and until 9 p.m. on Sunday, the announcement said, and then again from 9 to 10 a.m. on Monday. I think I should repeat that. The public will be permitted to file past the bier in the rotunda shortly after its arrival and until 9 p.m. on Sunday and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Monday. We are just informed that Ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, has arrived in Washington, and we have more for you on that now.
For the obsequies and these ceremonies will take place tomorrow. And I said this afternoon in New York that I thought that the tragedy of this day is beyond any instant comprehension. And all of us who knew him will bear the grief of his death until the day of ours. And all men everywhere who love justice and freedom and peace will bow their heads. At such a moment, one can only turn to prayer. Prayer to comfort our grief, to sustain Mrs. Kennedy and his family, and to strengthen President Johnson and to guide us in time to come. May God help us all.
And the voice you undoubtedly recognize as that of Adlai Stevenson. One wonders if memories, rather recent memories, came to Mr. Stevenson when he heard this hideous news. Of the time when he was in Dallas just a short time ago, when right-wing pickets who dislike his foreign policy and the administration's foreign policy generally, picketed him, and he actually got hit with a sign by one of them, an incident which he dismissed, but which perhaps he recalled now because of the president's death in Dallas. I think we've been talking about the career of Mr. Johnson for enough, for just a moment, and I think perhaps it might be appropriate for us to review some of the highlights in the career of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. His birth came on the 29th of May in 1917. He was born in Brookline, Massachusetts, the second of nine children to former ambassador to Great Britain, Joseph P. Kennedy, and his wife, Rose Kennedy. By the way, his body will be placed in the family plot in Brookline, Massachusetts. He graduated from Harvard cum laude in 1940 with a degree of Bachelor of Science. And in 1942, he wrote a book which was a best-selling book in this area of nonfiction. It was about the World War, and the book was Why England Slept. Between 1941 and 1945, he was, as I guess all of the world knows by now, thanks to a motion picture and thanks to all of the talk by all of the people who admired him, an officer in the United States Navy. He rose to the rank of lieutenant in command of a PT boat. In 1943, he was badly injured when his boat was rammed by a Japanese destroyer off the Solomon Islands, an occasion on which, again, as I assume almost everyone must know, he displayed tremendous heroism. Between 1947 and 1953, he served as a United States Congressman from Massachusetts. And this was the period during which one writer, who specialized in the area of the South Seas, tells of being in one such place. The name of the place doesn't come back to me at the moment. But a young man came through, he said, unattended by aides and unattended by official parties, wearing a wash-and-wear shirt, his armpits sweaty, a young man in a hurry. He came in and he said he wanted to know things. His name was John F. Kennedy. He didn't want to meet presidents and he didn't want to meet celebrities. He wanted to learn and he wanted to learn in a hurry. He was asked to whom did he want to speak. He said he wanted to speak to the newsmen. That was how he could learn. And this was the way he spent his life, learning as much as he possibly could and spending all of his time trying to do so. In 1952, John F. Kennedy was elected to the Senate of the United States, defeating for the first time Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. Two attractive young men from every possible point of view, both physical as well as intellectual, who met head-on. And Boston and its environs pushed Mr. Kennedy into the Senate. He liked the political fight, and he displayed it even at that time. In 1953, Senator Kennedy was married to Jacqueline Bouvier in Newport, Rhode Island. In 1954 and 1955, he was struck down by sickness, as has happened more than once to great men in the history of this country, and spent 6 months in the hospital undergoing and convalescing from major surgery on back injury, which was aggravated by the sinking of his PT boat. There were those who mourned for him even then as one whose life was just about gone, but the then Senator Kennedy refused to give in to this and fought back fiercely and successfully, even as he had during the war in which he had been a hero. In 1956, Senator Kennedy won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Profiles in Courage, one of the most quoted books of our time. In 1956, he narrowly missed winning the Democratic vice presidential nomination in Chicago, losing in a close contest to the late Senator Estes Kefauver, who was a Democrat from Tennessee, who also just recently died of a heart attack. I remember that contest very well. I was one of the correspondents, one of the many, many correspondents in Chicago, and it was an extremely interesting time. Adlai Stevenson was the nominee of the Democratic Party at that time, and he did not obey the usual procedure and protocol. He decided to throw the convention open. It was a peculiar time because you get swept up by conventions. All of us who were there, had we been thinking carefully, would have known that it didn't really make any difference. President Eisenhower had served a tremendously successful first term. He was greatly popular all over the country. The polls already indicated that there was nobody who had any conceivable chance to beat him. But the excitement of a convention is something that is completely unmeasurable by any standards that you can think of. And everybody thinks that anything can happen and that anybody can win. So that, therefore, when this convention was thrown open in 1956, there were caucuses and there were meetings called all over the hotels on the Chicago waterfront, because the man who got the nomination was going to be the man who fought hardest for it during the night. And there were meetings called here and there. Somebody said, Senator Kennedy is having a meeting. And elsewhere, Senator Kefauver was calling a meeting. And the senior senator from Minnesota was having one. All of these people are rushing back and forth, correspondents spending the night going from one meeting to another as the candidates tried to drum up strength to show that they had the popularity and the strength to get the nomination. Well, Mr. Kennedy, of course, did not get it. Estes Kefauver did. Perhaps at that time it was a favor to him, because he would have been, of course, the vice presidential candidate on a losing ticket. This did not stop another candidate once, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but it could have done so in this case. Nevertheless, he was a loser at that time, but he learned something, and we all discovered at that time that the Kennedy family knew a great deal about politics and had to be looked for in the future. In 1957, he returned to the Senate again. He became the father of his first child, Carolyn. In 1958, he won re-election to the Senate by an overwhelming vote. The Kennedy family was already thinking in terms of the presidential nomination, and they ran as hard as ever they could. They organized the campaign to a fare-thee-well in Massachusetts. There was no question in anyone's mind that Senator Kennedy would be re-elected. But the important thing to the Kennedy hopes was that the election, the re-election, should be so strong that it would boost his presidential chances greatly, and this is what actually happened. In 1960, on July 14th, Mr. Kennedy won the Democratic presidential nomination on the first ballot, and all of the country stood back in awe at the political prowess that the Kennedy family and their supporters had showed during the entire campaign, the fight in Wisconsin and the fight in West Virginia and all through, the organization that they had displayed. Well, in 1960, President Kennedy then defeated Vice President Richard Nixon for the presidency in a close-fought ballot that gave him a final edge of scarcely 100,000 ballots. In 1961, he became the father of a son, John Jr., his second child. 1961, too. In April, he started to have problems with Cuba, and Cuba seems to have haunted President Kennedy's life. He took full responsibility at that time for the ill-fated Cuban invasion, which was staged by dissident exile groups, and there was vast dispute over the extent the United States had promised aid and the extent to which it should have, under any circumstances, given aid. In 1962, in October, he forced Russia to withdraw its missiles, the missiles that it had secreted in Cuba with atomic warheads, and all of the world breathed a sigh of relief. In 1964, he was assassinated on November 22nd. This, a very brief thumbnail sketch, hardly, certainly not satisfactory, but there'll be more in this area later. Overseas, our friends have been mourning with us, those who admired the president, other chiefs of state. The BBC, this afternoon, or rather this evening, had a tribute to Mr. Kennedy, which was begun by the Prime Minister, Conservative Prime Minister, Sir Alexander Douglas Hume.
In 3 short years of his presidency, he left an indelible mark on his country and on the world. And for us in Britain, his loss is a deep and a sad one, because he was the most loyal and faithful of allies. Tonight, I fear, there is no comfort that I can bring to the American people, nor indeed to ourselves, nor indeed to men anywhere who care for tolerance and liberty and justice and peace, unless it be this, that this dreadful deed should shock us all to dedicate ourselves anew to those things which he liked, which he loved, and for which he worked during his life. And if we can help to bring to men the liberty, justice, and peace for which he did so much, then we shall be doing something to serve the causes in the service of which he himself died. Now, waiting in our Manchester studio is Mr. Harold Wilson, the leader of the opposition.
The Prime Minister, I think, spoke for all of us when he expressed the deep sympathy of this nation, of our people, to Mrs. Kennedy, her family, to his relatives and his associates in the American government on this tragic, this senseless act that has taken place today. It has come as a tremendous shock to everyone in this country. When I heard the news, I was addressing a large meeting, and when it was announced, all the people in the hall let out an involuntary gasp of horror, and as they stood in sympathy, in tribute to President Kennedy, one could sense that they were almost stunned by what they had heard. Like the Prime Minister, all of us who had the privilege of knowing President Kennedy will think, I think, perhaps first of the man. He was young and vigorous. When you talked to him in the White House, even though you were all the time conscious that you were talking to a man who wielded enormous power and tremendous responsibility, the talk itself was as intimate and frank and as free as if you were talking at your own fireside. He had a very rapid grasp of any subject that one was discussing, and we knew that he had, of course, behind his words, a remarkable knowledge based on the briefing that he had from that vast administrative machine. Above all, he gave a sense of vigor and of purpose to everything that he did. I know a good number of his associates. Some of them I've known for many years, and on my visits to Washington, I've been able to sense from them the tremendous inspiration and, above all, the sense of mission and of purpose that he instilled into them. He dies now after nearly 3 years as President of the United States. And the Prime Minister is right. So many of the plans, the ideals that he formed, have not reached fruition, and tragically some of them, I'm afraid, will die with him. But I think the main purpose of his work will go on. Now, what were his achievements? One's got to recognize that in many cases he did not succeed in carrying through what he had set his hand to, partly because of the delays of the American legislative process and for other reasons. But I think what he did achieve was to bring a new sense of purpose to the American people. He did waken up America and get them moving again in an economic sense. He tried, perhaps not all that successfully, though it was not his fault, to get a sense of social purpose into the American political scene, particularly in relation to the welfare for the aged, provision for education. But above all, perhaps, he will be remembered, so far as domestic affairs are concerned, by his great and courageous fight for human rights. His great fight, which once begun, had to go on to the end, for the ending of racial conflict in the United States. His administrative work, I think others will pay tribute to, but at any rate, one can feel that when a decision had to be taken, because of the keen brain, the keen sense of administration he brought, that decision was taken in full light of all the knowledge. Nothing ever went through in a slipshod way. He might make mistakes because all human beings are fallible. But at any rate, every decision was fully documented, and he took his decision with courage and with sincerity. In his overseas relations, I think he has initiated a new era in East-West relationships. He stood firm for American power and for building up American defenses. But he never wanted to employ those defenses in a crusade against those with whom he disagreed. He wanted to build up that strength for the purpose of making peace possible. I was in Russia this year when he made his famous speech to the American University, and I heard, I think I was the first to hear Premier Khrushchev's reaction to it. What one felt was that the great power of the United States was being used and put forward for reaching a peaceful solution of the problems of East-West relationships. What one felt was that those in America who in past years had talked about the inevitability of war, just as there were those in Russia who talked in those terms, had now been given their quietus by this great and this statesmanlike speech. I remember when I met President Kennedy in April, walking round the White House garden with him, and we were talking about history. Because he was a great reader of history books, and he felt, as so many other statesmen have, that you can never really understand the problems of our age except through the eyes of history. And we found we had one favorite book in common, Carl Sandburg's Life of Abraham Lincoln, which both of us seem to know almost by heart, so far as that moving passage about the death of Lincoln was concerned. And as we talked about this, he told me how he'd visited Gettysburg the previous day. Now in the very week of the centenary of Gettysburg, he too has died. When Lincoln was murdered, one of his closest associates said, "Now he belongs to the ages." I think that is the way in which we shall think of the death of President Kennedy, a young man cut off with only a small fraction of his work completed, but a man who has given an inspiration to those who come after him.
And now the leader of the Liberal Party, Mr. Joe Grimmer. This is a numbing tragedy. And of course, in the first place, it is a personal tragedy. And I would like to add my sympathy to that of the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition for President Kennedy's family. He was a natural, charming, gay, vigorous man. And as a man, he has been struck down. And our first thoughts must surely go to his wife and to his children. And again, I think, like other people who have spoken already, that it is appropriate to think at this time of Lincoln, because Kennedy, too, grappled with some of the same difficulties which Lincoln tackled. The difficulty of race relations, the whole difficulty of reaching out as a leader of a free people to meet new problems and new opportunities. And far outside America, Kennedy did stand, not only in the free world, but I think throughout the world, for a new approach to these new problems which we all feel. And I believe in Russia. Tonight there will be genuine sorrow for this appalling act. I don't myself feel that there is much that I can add to what has already been said about him, at least not now. All through Britain, there will be quite ordinary people this evening who will feel this as a totally unexpected personal tragedy, as though one of their own relations had been killed. And all we can do is to go on, is to continue to do our bit, to follow on the lines which he had laid down, to build up good relations so far as we can, between people of different race and different color, to be firm without being offensive in the protection of our rights and our freedom. And above all, to try and live our political lives, those that were in politics, in the same sort of way that he did, with a dedication, but yet with a naturalness, with a lack of pomposity, his ability to get across to people in a way which I think was peculiarly his own. As I say, he is going to be deeply mourned for a very long time. And tonight all we can do is to send our sympathy to his family and to the great nation which he led.
Mr. Kennedy had been President of the United States for just under 3 years. Let us now go back on film to the autumn of 1960, as John Fitzgerald Kennedy gained the narrow victory which put him into the White House.
It seems little more than yesterday that the young senator from Massachusetts, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was in the throes of his hectic election campaign right across the United States. By the time Inauguration Day came round, there was already a feeling that change was in the air, radical and refreshing change. Above all, the atmosphere Kennedy created was one of clearing away smugness and self-satisfaction and facing realities, especially unpleasant realities. And together with this, there was a sense of challenge, perhaps even something approaching a crusade.
Life in 1961 will not be easy. Wishing it, predicting it, even asking for it will not make it so. There will be further setbacks before the tide is turned, but turn it we must. In the words of a great president, whose birthday we honor today, closing his final State of the Union message 16 years ago, we pray that we may be worthy of the unlimited opportunities that God has given us.
But the Americans weren't to be the first to realize the unlimited opportunities. It was the Russians. The first real setback to Kennedy's new administration came with Gagarin's space flight, which blazoned Russia's rocket superiority right around the world. Then, 2 days later, the old enemy dealt an even more crushing blow by frustrating the American-aided revolutionaries in their disastrous attack on Cuba. Even if the seeds of this fiasco were sown in Eisenhower's time, the blame fell on Kennedy, and he took it. It was with these two setbacks already behind him that Kennedy set off on his first European tour. It was clear from his reception in Paris that after only 5 months in office, he and his wife had established an almost unquenchable popularity. But it wasn't only to meet the European leaders that he crossed the Atlantic in those early days of his presidency. In Vienna, he had his first meeting with Mr. Khrushchev, not a summit conference, but a chance for the two leaders of the world to sum each other up. And many of their subsequent policies must have been based on the estimates they made of each other then. Later that month, he came to London. That was in June 1961. And now that he is dead, it's extraordinary to realize that this man, who imprinted his stamp on our time so indelibly, did so as President of the United States of America in just 2 years and 10 months.
And that was a tribute to President Kennedy from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, and from the leaders of the various parties in Great Britain, including the Prime Minister. We'll be back with more news involving the succession of the presidency and more news concerning the Kennedy family and the former president in just a moment.
The NBC radio network will stay on the air with continuous coverage until 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will resume broadcasting at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time Saturday, tomorrow, with continuous coverage. We pause 10 seconds for station identification.
WNBC AM and FM, New York. 11:32, the temperature 58.
The president was to have delivered an address tonight to the Dallas Citizens Council, the Dallas Assembly, and the Graduate Research Center of the Southwest at the Trade Mart in Dallas. I would like to read you some excerpts from the speech that President Kennedy was to have given. He said, "In a world of complex and continuing problems, in a world full of frustrations and irritations, America's leadership must be guided by the lights of learning and reason, or else those who confuse rhetoric with reality and the plausible with the possible will gain the popular ascendancy with their seemingly swift and simple solutions to every world problem." He spoke of his people, saying there will always be dissident voices heard in the land, expressing opposition without alternatives, finding fault but never favor, perceiving gloom on every side, and seeking influence without responsibility. And those voices are inevitable. But today, other voices are heard in the land, voices preaching doctrines wholly unrelated to reality, wholly unsuited to the 60s, doctrines which apparently assume that words will suffice without weapons, that vituperation is as good as victory, and that peace is a sign of weakness. At a time when the national debt is steadily being reduced in terms of its burden on our economy, they see that debt as the greatest single threat to our security. The president went on and said, "I realize that this nation often tends to identify turning points in world affairs with the major addresses which preceded them. But it was not the Monroe Doctrine that kept all Europe away from this hemisphere. It was the strength of the British fleet and the width of the Atlantic Ocean. It was not General Marshall's speech at Harvard which kept communism out of Western Europe. It was the strength and stability made possible by our military and economic assistance. In this administration also, it has been necessary at times to issue specific warnings, warnings that we could not stand by and watch the communists conquer Laos by force or intervene in the Congo or swallow West Berlin or maintain offensive missiles on Cuba. But while our goals were at least temporarily obtained in these and other instances, our successful defense of freedom was due not to the words we used, but to the strength we stood ready to use on behalf of the principles we stand ready to defend. And he spoke of the different kinds of strength. He spoke of nuclear strength and of our strategic bombers. And then he went on to say, "But the lessons of the last decade have taught us that freedom cannot be defended by strategic nuclear power alone. We have, therefore, in the last 3 years, accelerated the development and deployment of tactical nuclear weapons. Nor can Europe or any other continent rely on nuclear forces alone," President Kennedy would have said, "whether they are strategic or tactical. We have radically improved the readiness of our conventional forces," and he went on to describe that readiness and talked about Operation Big Lift, the operation that took so many of our troops more than a division to Europe. "American military might," he said, "should not and need not stand alone against the ambitions of international communism. Our security and strength, in the last analysis, directly depend on the security and strength of others. Our foreign aid program is not growing in size. It is, on the contrary, smaller now than in previous years," Mr. Kennedy would have said. These are some of the points that he would have made in the speech he was scheduled to deliver tonight in Dallas. What about the future? What about congressional attitudes? And what about the succession of President Johnson to the presidency of the United States and the position in the White House? We have a report on that now from Robert Abernathy in Washington.
Although Lyndon Johnson has become president, no one under our system of succession automatically moves up now to vice president. John McCormick of Massachusetts, Speaker of the House of Representatives, 72 years old, would now become president should Lyndon Johnson die. But Mr. McCormick does not automatically become vice president, nor does he expect to assume additional duties, for instance, on those occasions when the new president might be away from Washington. President Johnson met Speaker McCormick and the other leaders of the House and Senate this evening. Mr. Johnson was described afterwards by one who was there as humble and chastened. The Republican leader of the Senate, Everett Dirksen, said earlier this evening that he thought Congress would not change its plan to continue work until December 20th. There are appropriations bills, for instance, which must be passed. Other Capitol leaders echo this feeling. "I think we should carry on," one said. "Congress must show the world continuity." Congressional leaders know Lyndon Johnson well. They remember him as an effective Senate leader, not afraid to make decisions. Tonight, they expect Congress to work with him sympathetically, giving him every chance they can to become accustomed to his new burdens. This is Robert Abernathy, NBC News, Washington.
The telegrams of condolences from the countries of the free world and some of the countries of the communist world continue to pour in. From France, a message from the French Premier, Monsieur Georges Pompidou, to President Lyndon Johnson said, "Deeply moved by the tragic loss experienced by the United States on the death of President Kennedy, whose courage and great gifts as a statesman were admired by all the French people. I wish to convey to you the grief felt by all my fellow countrymen. Rest assured that at a time when under such cruel circumstances you take up your high office, my colleagues of the French government and myself join with you in a feeling of most grieving and most loyal friendship. Everyone, you get the feeling, searches for words to try to find them, to try and find the right ones to show the strength of our feelings. Everyone all over the world, and it's extremely difficult, but the feelings are all there." A telegram to Mrs. Kennedy from General Douglas MacArthur said, "I realize the utter futility of words at such a time, but the world of civilization shares the poignancy of this monumental tragedy. As a former comrade in arms," said General Douglas MacArthur, "his death kills something within me." And of course, General MacArthur was the supreme commander, a man of great renown, and during the World War, at the time when the former president was a rather minor lieutenant junior grade in charge of a PT boat. The governor of New Jersey, Governor Hughes, a Democrat, also had a reaction to this tragedy. Let's hear that now.
I share with my countrymen today a shock and grief which defies description. A young and fearless American has died in the service of his country, even as many years ago his body absorbed the wounds of battle in the name of freedom. Now John Kennedy belongs to history, and his courageous spirit joins the fellowship of those who never flinched in the doing of right and in the search for justice. May God bless him and his family and the America he loves so deeply. To President Johnson, now assuming the burdens of an office on which rest the hopes of all humanity, go the prayers and dedication of every one of us.
And that was Governor Richard Hughes of New Jersey. Another statement, which is, well, certainly interesting, comes from the American Communist Party. The address is given as 23 West 26th Street in New York City. The statement referred to this dastardly crime and said it was the ultimate depravity of the pro-fascist ultra-right forces. I'll give you the quote in more detail. It is the ultimate depravity of the pro-fascist ultra-right forces, of the fiendish Dixiecrats and racists who will stop at nothing to destroy the democratic institutions of the country, to threaten the peace of the world, and to turn back the clock of history. This seems to be the communists following the Soviet line, as you heard earlier from NBC's John Chancellor in West Berlin. The official communist line with which they were stuck, because they made the statements before we actually had any details, was to the effect that there was a rightist organization and rightist individuals who had been responsible for the shooting of President Kennedy. The later information, of course, seems to indicate otherwise, that it was, in fact, an individual whose sympathies lay quite strongly with the communists and their cause. But the American Communist Party is following along the lines laid down by it, for it, by their communist masters elsewhere. A statement from Senator Barry Goldwater, the Republican conservative from Arizona, mentioned, of course, frequently as a possible Republican candidate and the man who many people think would have been the opponent to President Kennedy in the next year's election, was that it is both shocking and dreadful that a thing like this could happen in a free country. Senator Goldwater learned of the president's death at a Chicago airport. He was flying to Indiana for the funeral of his mother-in-law, Mrs. Ann Davis Johnson. He telephoned a statement to his Washington Senate office. Senator Goldwater said, "The president's death is a profound loss to the nation and the free world. He and I were personal friends. It is also a great loss to me. Mrs. Goldwater and I offer our heartfelt sympathies to Mrs. Kennedy and the president's family." High officials, governors, and senators from all over the country are trying to express their regret, their sincere regret and misery over this terrible thing. And we have now a statement issued by Governor James Davis of the state of Louisiana.
"I'm shocked that such a thing as this could happen in this country in this day and age. This is murder in its most vile form. The warped mind that causes crime apparently felt that political questions were involved. But the basic issue is whether the President of the United States, or for that matter any individual, can be free to express his views without having to sacrifice his life. Differences of opinion can be settled at the ballot boxes. And to depart from this is to depart from morality and democracy alike, and undermines everything this country stands for. I am sorry for the President's family, and I extend to President Johnson my best wishes to him during the difficult and trying times ahead."
And from Governor Cal Rolvag of Minnesota, this statement.
"The grief and the great sense of loss all Americans are experiencing at the death of our president. Thousands of Minnesotans have thrilled to his presence in our state and have rallied to the great ideals he represented and fought for on behalf of all Americans. Throughout America and throughout Minnesota tonight, there is a deep sorrow that this most fearless and determined of leaders has not been allowed to see the fruition of his dream, the total emancipation and loosening of the spirit of all human beings everywhere in the world. I'm certain that countless millions extend their anguished sympathy to the president's family and friends. In consolation, we can say that the spirit of President Kennedy will live on. His principles, his devotion to the welfare of all people, cannot be his assassin and those like him do not understand is that you can never kill that which is just or kill that which is right or still that which seeks to ennoble and uplift the existence of all men. There is great anger in our hearts tonight, but I'm certain that if the president had lived, he would have said, let us have pity on this man.
How's that?
Governor Rolvag of Minnesota. Just in this information, President Kennedy's body will be brought from Bethesda Naval Hospital to the White House sometime during the night. This according to Acting Presidential Press Secretary Andrew Hatcher. The body will lie there in repose on a platform called a catafalque, similar to the one, in fact, which was used for President Lincoln, who fell to an assassin's bullet in 1865. Mr. Hatcher said the body now is in the care of Gawler's funeral home. Undertakers of this establishment are preparing the body for burial at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, according to Mr. Hatcher. Speaking of the White House, we have some information from there concerning the new president and the problems he faces and the other problems attendant. From NBC's Richard Valeriani, we join him now at the White House.
The White House has just announced that the body of President Kennedy will be brought sometime tonight to the East Room of the White House, where it will lie in repose through tomorrow. There it will be viewed by the new president, Lyndon Johnson, members of the late president's family, and other high-ranking officials of the government and diplomatic representatives in the Capitol. The White House said that the body will rest on a raised platform, a catafalque, similar to the one used for President Abraham Lincoln, who was also assassinated about 100 years ago. An honor guard will be in continuous attendance. The catafalque will be flanked by two lighted candles. The coffin containing President Kennedy's remains is now at Bethesda Naval Hospital. That is where the widow, Mrs. Kennedy, is spending the night. She will return to the White House in the morning. These other bits of information became available just a short while ago. The White House said that for the time being, President Johnson will work in the more familiar surroundings of his vice presidential offices in the executive office building across the street from the White House. The six cabinet members who were on their way to Japan for economic talks and then turned around when they heard of the president's assassination are now scheduled to arrive shortly after midnight in Washington. They'll view the body in repose tomorrow, and Secretary of State Dean Rusk is scheduled to meet with the new president at 9:30 in the morning. This is Richard Valeriani, NBC News, at the White House in Washington.
Other news in connection with the shooting and in connection with the world and its reception of the news. Texas Governor John Connally, who was wounded today during the assassination of President Kennedy, is now described as being in good condition. A spokesman at the Parkland Hospital in Dallas says the governor still does not know the president is dead. Governor Connally underwent a four-hour chest operation after he was wounded this afternoon. An aide says he came to and asked for his wife, and then he asked her about their children. Doctors report the governor is, quote, mentally alert and comfortable, although he has not yet asked about Mr. Kennedy. The bullet which wounded him entered his right shoulder and then emerged through his chest. One rib had to be removed during surgery and a cut lung repaired. But again, we repeat this one piece of good news that the governor of Texas, Mr. John Connally, is described by medical spokesman as being in good condition. Telling the world about the news, Radio Liberty opened up all of its 18 transmitters with close to 2 million watts of power today to bring all aspects of President Kennedy's assassination to its large audience or anticipated large audience within the Soviet Union. Their programming at Radio Liberty is in Russian and in 16 other languages and is now being carried on repeatedly, giving a future profile of the new president, Lyndon Johnson, which assures Soviet citizens that the administration's current policies will continue as before. And this is confirmed by other sources, anticipating from Mr. Johnson's statements in a variety of fields and at a variety of times that he is as one with the former president in the area of foreign policy. Radio Liberty has been broadcasting a special feature to the world and to the Soviet Union on the peaceful transition of authority to the new president in accordance with constitutional procedures. procedures. This, of course, presents an obvious contrast to the way there have been successions in the Soviet Union and in other communist countries. The program shows the orderliness of government processes during emergencies such as that of today. All Russians will take this to heart, remembering the death of Stalin and the jockeying for power and the murder and eventually the final survival of one candidate alone, Mr. Khrushchev, after the elimination of all of his rivals. Other special programs now being repeated on all Radio Liberty channels include excerpts from President Kennedy's American University speech in Washington, D.C. last June, which was considered by many as a significant contribution to world understanding. It's generally thought that that speech, the one delivered by President Kennedy at American University, was the speech which eventually led to the partial nuclear test ban treaty. Mr. Johnson grimly assumed the burdens of the presidency tonight and in an immediate flurry of activity won a pledge of bipartisan congressional cooperation in the dark days that will follow President Kennedy's assassination. Speaking of congressional reaction, we have a substantial amount of it here, which I'll pass on to you. My God, what are we coming to? These were the only words that Speaker John McCormick could utter when he was told of the death of the president. Senate Democratic leader Mike Mansfield immediately summoned all senators to the floor for a special period of prayer while the president was dying. He called the slaying not only a great tragedy for the nation, but it is, I think, he said, a mark against the respectability and responsibility of some of our citizens. Senate Republican leader Everett Dirksen, on learning of the shooting, could only exclaim, "Oh, God, this is the most distressing thing that could ever happen." After the president died, Senator Dirksen still could barely summon words. He called the crime incredible and told newsmen, "I'm a little bewildered, as I know the nation and the whole world will be." Of the assassin, Dirksen said, "The gates of hell must have been concealed and congealed inside of him." He mourned President Kennedy as the victim of a violent and indescribable...